Good evening, Truth Seekers. Malloy here on the NOVAM Radio Network. Yeah, Friday is my day to play. Thank God it's Friday. What a weird week. Have I been saying that every Friday? I think I have been. The giggling killer had the gall to visit Bethesda Medical Center today. And once again, used a handful of soldiers that are maimed and broken because of his policies as a photo op backdrop to kick off Memorial Day weekend. That's before he hippie hops off to Camp David for yet another vacation. He works so hard, doesn't he? Is it Camp David or did he go to Prairie Chapel? Camp David? He gave out 5 Purple Hearts and about 15 minutes of lip service to the veterans. He's wounded and he's created. Then he jumped into the presidential limo and told his aide to break out a bottle of Jack Black. It's the weekend! God damn! Got to clear something up here. I don't know if anybody cares about this except me and the people who've been emailing me, but the issue came up last night. I brought it up about a musician named Django, and that's all I could think of in the moment. I said he was a blues guitarist because a friend of mine who is a blues guitarist named his son Django about 18, 19, no, but I guess Django the kid now is probably in his early 20s. Well, I got a bunch of emails straightening me out. And here is the end of the emails. Here it is in its entirety, that whole issue. And I know nobody cares, but I just think it ought to be cleared up. This comes from KJ, Bard Conius. You know who he is. And he writes, Mike, Django Reinhardt was a Belgian gypsy whose quintet performed at the Hot Club in Paris during the late 1930s. He was not a violinist. He was a guitarist. The violinist was Stefan Grappelli, who is also pretty remarkable. The amazing thing about Django is that on his left hand, the hand that with which he played the frets, he had only a thumb. I don't mean played the frets. I mean pressed on the frets. Oh, God, don't send me emails. The amazing thing about Django is on his left hand, the fret hand, he had only a thumb, an index, and middle finger. The other two, had been lost years earlier in a fire. Django did more with those two fingers and thumb than many guitarists have been able to do with all 5 digits intact. Hope this is helpful. KJ, also known as Bard Conius. And thanks to everybody who wrote in, including Roz, who wrote in from Canada, and all the folks who wrote about Django. Now, I didn't want to do this, but I guess we have to. I got an email from James in Seattle who said, Mike, I was very moved, not by Boner's crying jag the other day, something about having courage or some such crapola. So in checking into this clown's valorous military service background, I kept coming across his listing, the United States Navy, 1968. I couldn't figure out why just 1 year. But of course, it wasn't just 1 year. It was 8 weeks from start to finish. Now, he was honorably discharged for a bad back after 8 weeks. But of course, he didn't even complete Navy boot camp. So it is highly disingenuous for him to suggest he ever served in the U.S. Navy. At least it is highly disingenuous to the rest of us vets, and especially combat vets. Rumors have it he was discharged prior to completing boot camp for chronic crying, something I am definitely inclined to believe. Take care, James in Seattle. So here we are. We want to play this for you. This was on the floor of the House the other day when everybody was giving their pitch about the funding murder bill that Bush wanted and the Democrats gave him. As you listen to this guy, John Boner, the House Minority Leader, you can smell the liquor. I swear you can smell the liquor. It just reeks out of this drunk freak. But listen up as John Boner takes the stage.
I know there are differences in this chamber, members on both sides of the aisle who feel differently. about our mission in Iraq and our chances of success there. I know when I came here, and every 2 years since I've been here, on the opening day, we all stand here. We raise our right hands and swear to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States.
And then don't.
There are a lot of my colleagues that have heard me make this statement that I didn't come here to be a congressman.
Came here to be a lobbyist.
I came here to do something. And I think at the top of our list,
I love you, man,
is providing for the safety and security of the American people. That's at the top of our list.
That's the top of our list.
And after 3,000 of our fellow citizens died at the hands of these terrorists, when are we going to stand up and take them on?
Bastards.
When are we going to defeat them? Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you.
Yeah.
If we don't do it now,
we'll do it.
And if we don't have the courage to defeat this enemy, we will long, long regret it.
Okay.
So thank you for the commitment to get the job done today. How you about?
Yeah, you about. Let's go get a drink. I come out of here in 2 years and raise my finger or hand.
Isn't that pathetic? Isn't that just so crushingly, stupefyingly pathetic?
Come on, everybody, let's sign up and kill some more Iraqis. I don't understand. I understand the hesitancy on the floor of this body. I can't get my mind around it. We're not asking that much. There's another $100 billion to go kill some more people. What's wrong with? I don't know. I go through this every 2 years. I'm thirsty. Man, what time is it? Thank you and good night.
It's just, it's a zoo. The Republican Party, you talk about caging, the Republican Party is a zoo. Drunks, child molesters, religious fanatics, warmongers who would run at the sound of a firecracker going off. Destabilizers, cheats, adulterers, serial adulterers. Just goes on and on and on.
I love you, man. We just got to kill these people. You know, these Iraqis came over here on September 11th. In 2001, killed 2,000, 3,000, pick a number, of our fellow Americans.
John, they were Saudis.
And all we're trying to do is go back and kill 700 or 800 million of them. That's all. What? Huh? My time's up? All right, I'm gone. I'm out of here. I'll see you next time I have to stand up here and pee all over myself like this and slobber.
What a group. What an incredible group, huh? Do you know, 40 years ago, this year, well, that's kind of redundant, Malloy. 40 years ago this summer was the Summer of Love in San Francisco. Can you believe that? I got some more to say about that here in the next segment, because there's a new exhibit at the Whitney Museum in New York. The Museum of American Art. Big review in today's New York Times, and I want to quote a little bit from the review. All right, stick around. Miles to go before we sleep. I'm Mike Malloy. This is the Nova M Radio Network.
I love you, man. I just gotta kill things.
Is this like a huge distillery?
I love you, man. 21 past the hour. This is from Maureen regarding the program last night. She writes, Mike, taking down the Democrats feels like defeat. It feels like we are doing the job for the Republicans. I was down on the Democrats last night. We need to be bringing out all the things that the Republicans are so much worse on than the Democrats, like the political firings of the federal attorneys. We cannot fall into just saying that the Republicans are so bad there's no more need to talk about them. This little garbled there, Maureen. I cringe when I hear people saying that they won't vote for Democrats. You may not be totally happy with the Democrats, but that reaction only gets Republicans elected or selected. There is more to this bill than just Iraq. The devil is in the details. I'm not sure why the Democrats don't want to talk about it. There are important things in the bill that the Democrats haven't been able to get otherwise, so please don't do the Republicans' work for them. I like Tom Hartman saying, if you don't like what the Democrats are doing, get involved with the local party. Also, people could try to get the right people elected in the primaries. The Democratic Party is all we have. We can't give up on it without giving up. Maureen. Well, I hear you, and appreciate what you had to say, Maureen, but the Democratic Party is not all we have. It really isn't. And like I say, I'm pretty much over it. I don't know where my next stop is going to be, politically speaking, but like I mentioned last night, democratic socialism seems to be the way to go. I don't know. Check it out. And this is from Blue Meanie, who writes, whenever President George W. Bush appears or speaks somewhere, doesn't your heart just swell with pride that he, above anyone else, is our president? Yesterday's Rose Garden press conference illustrates just what I mean. In typical Bush speak, George Bush can distill the most complicated of issues down to one sentence or two. It is a gift few politicians have. The following is taken directly from his press conference yesterday. The question was, Mr. President, why is Osama bin Laden still at large? Bush answered, we played this last night. Why is he at large? Because we haven't got him yet, Jim. That's why. Why is he at large? Because we haven't got him yet, Jim. That's why. Oh, Blue Meanie writes, now I understand. Thank you, Mr. President, for boiling down to simple terms even us Democrats can understand. The problem is bin Laden is at large because we haven't caught him yet. Huh. I never realized that before, not until you described the problem so succinctly yesterday. Why have we not realized this before? Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you. Signed, Steve-O. Yeah, that was pretty grim. And from BuzzFlash, an item here. Bush has picked a new Surgeon General, one who kills veterans, hates gays, and loves Republicans. His name is Dr. James Holsinger, and Bush decided yesterday that he's going to be the nation's next Surgeon General. And as BuzzFlash points out, sure enough, his record is mired with incompetence, zealous conservatism, and, of course, sizable campaign contributions to Republicans. This guy really, really, really has a trail of bodies behind him. BuzzFlash says, as chief medical director of the Department of Veterans Affairs under Bush's father, Dr. Holsinger was neglecting our vets long before Walter Reed made it fashionable. A government investigation found, quote, several cases in which incompetence and neglect led to the deaths of patients, end quote. Dr. Holsinger was forced to admit blame for the deaths of 6 patients in less than a year at a single Chicago hospital alone. But, of course, and you can well guess this truth seeker, that his problems weren't limited to Chicago, not this freak, in Wyoming. A patient scheduled for surgery for a treatable cancer died after he was ignored for 45 days following the resignation of the staff urologist over a contract dispute that Holsinger was involved in. 30 VA hospitals were found to have, quote, high numbers of patient complications and other indicators of substandard care, end quote. This is while, you know, this guy was in charge of VA hospitals back in Bush 1. A decade later, Holsinger was appointed Kentucky's cabinet
Secretary for Health and Family Services. By the end of his tenure, a Kentucky newspaper found that the state was at the bottom of the nation for almost every health measure. Kentuckians died at a rate of 18% above the national average, the newspaper reported. A Kentucky intern is trained in the Philippines said, quote, "We don't have to worry about foreign aggressors. We're killing ourselves off. I see a lot of illnesses here similar to a third world country." And there's more. I'll share it with you when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Molloy. This is Nova Am.
Twice as cloudy as I've been the night before, and I went in seeking clarity.
Why is he large? Because we hadn't got him yet, Jim. That's why. And he's hiding. And we're looking. And we will continue to look.
Before the hour, I'll love the Indigo Girls, a couple of Kathy's friends, as a matter of fact. Back to the Buzz Flash editorial or news analysis on Bush's pick for the new Surgeon General, Dr. James Holsinger. This guy has left a trail of death and destruction behind him no matter where he goes, whether it was in Kentucky, whether as the Cabinet Secretary of Health and Family Services for that state, whether it was the Director of the Department of Veterans Affairs under Bush 1. He's been involved in lawsuits where he's been charged with incompetence that resulted in the deaths of patients. It just goes on and on and on. So, as BuzzFlash points out, why does Bush want Holsinger to be the nation's top doctor? Well, for starters, he hates gay people. That's there's a couple of gold stars for him right there. As president of the United Methodist Church's Judicial Council, Holsinger ruled in 2004 that, quote, "the practice of homosexuality is a chargeable offense for clergy," end quote. Now, this was after a highly publicized internal trial for an openly lesbian pastor, Karen Damon. In 1991, Holsinger resigned from a church panel studying homosexuality, quote, "because he felt certain its conclusions would follow liberal lines," end quote. And last year, a Methodist pastor blasted Dr. Holsinger for essentially trying to embezzle some $20 million from the Methodist Church through a charity that Holsinger chairs. Holsinger has lost in court twice on this matter, but continues to appeal through the legal system. And the, excuse me, the creme de la creme of this litany of crap on this guy is the fact that he has contributed more than $16,000 to Republicans, including George W. Bush. I like what BuzzFlash closes by saying, "Dr. Holsinger seems like a great choice for the vice president to take hunting."
So he resigned from the council studying homosexuality because what?
He felt certain its conclusions would follow liberal lines.
Closeted!
You think he resigned because he might be a non-out gay man? Huh? Holsinger? Dr. Holsinger? All right, one more email here. This is from, and this kind of ties into the Summer of Love thing that was 40 years ago. That's astonishing to me. That's just astonishing. This is from Kay in San Francisco, who writes, "Dear Mike, during last night's show, you remarked that you find it astonishing that no one is able to stop the giggling killer from continuing his lethal antics in Iraq. Your statement reminded me of something. We're at the end of another school year, and to wrap up U.S. history, I've been showing parts of the outstanding documentary Berkeley in the 60s. I could draw a million parallels between then and now, from the placards the protesters waved to their feelings toward the war. There is one major difference, however, and it was summed up by one of the members of the free speech movement as he was interviewed for the documentary. He stated, and I'm paraphrasing, that as 1967 turned to 1968, many in the anti-war movement lost patience. They made a decision to go from peaceful protests to, quote, taking it to the streets, end quote. The idea was to cause chaos, not necessarily violence, but chaos, here, to drive home the point that with the war raging on, America did not have the resources to restore calm in our own streets. I often hear people, including my own students, ask, why did people do something back then, and why don't they do something now? I think that in that student's comment is part of the answer. We have not found it within ourselves to take it up a notch, at least not yet. Dare we hope that this latest betrayal by the Democrats will be a push in that direction? If I weren't preparing my final exams and grading papers, I could give you many more examples from the film, but in the meantime, I would strongly recommend it to your listeners. Talk about a blast from the past and a lesson for today. Kay in San Francisco. The name of it is Berkeley in the 60s. Berkeley in the 60s. It's a documentary. Now, I read this email after I had... I was looking at the New York Times this morning. I went to the art section. There's an art review of... an exhibit called Summer of Love, Art of the Psychedelic Era. It's at the Whitney Museum of American Art, and it's going to hit the road. It's going to be in Canada. It's going to be in Australia. It's going to be here in Atlanta. And the reviewer, Holland Cotter, makes the point that tear gas, pot, and patchouli were indeed the scents of the 1960s. You can almost detect the last two. Pot and patchouli wafting through Summer of Love, Art of the Psychedelic Era at the Whitney Museum. If you live in the New York area, you should go see this. It's got a limited tour coming up. I think I read it's only going to be in five cities, one of which is in Australia. But it said there's some things that Holland Cotter pointed out. What was happening 40 years ago when America was losing its mind in order to save its soul? Cotter writes, the so-called Summer of Love was a local event with national repercussions. Word spread that a human being would convene at Golden Gate Park in San Francisco in January 1967. That's when word got out. Young people from across the country poured into the city, and by the summer they had filled the hippie neighborhood of Haight-Ashbury. And we're crashing in parks and streets. The news media, the party went off as planned. The news media were all over the photogenic counterculture with its jangly music, exotic drugs, and outlandish mores. This was the flower power instant, and it was over in a flash. But for many people, it is what the 60s were all about. The decade was the furthest thing from laid back. It was wired, confused, and confusing. With constant clashes around race, class, gender, and politics, idealism, and ideology. That's why for anyone who wasn't around then, the period is all but impossible to know. And for anyone who was around, it's hard to describe without sounding either nostalgic or bitter. Music still gives the sense of it all. Say you were a middle-class American white kid in 1964. What were you listening to? Jan and Dean, the Shangri-Las. Surfers and bikers. Then you and some friends see the Beatles on their first American tour. They're so new, four skinny, pale, dandy-ish guys with femme haircuts singing Love Me Do. 4 years later, the Beatles are in India, and you're in college, at a concert, smoking grass, and this truly unusual woman named Janice is swinging her hair across the stage. She's commanding you to take a little piece of her heart. She's white, but she sounds black, and she's reckless, eyes closed, right at the edge of the stage. She'll fall. Does she care? Outside, there's a war, and the world feels weird, but not in here, tonight. Then you're tripping, and Jimi Hendrix is up there on some other stage with this tremendous light show cued to the pulse of the cosmos exploding behind him. No flowers now. No mellow. He strangles the national anthem, then ignites his guitar. Someone behind or beside you whispers, "Detroit is on fire." A Buddhist monk torched himself in Saigon. People are making draft card bonfires. Flames are spilling out of the music, spreading off the stage and into life. You don't know where acid stops and reality starts. Timothy Leary, among others, pontificated about how we should change the world by changing our heads. But as drugs became widely available, the activist dimension of getting high faded. Tripping was something you did on Saturday night. To many people who came of age between 63 and 72, political intensity was the defining feature of the period and its most interesting art, and it never let up. In 1965, anti-war protests started. 25,000 students marched on Washington that year, and they grew larger and more frequent. By 1967, more than 400,000 troops had been sent to Vietnam. Che Guevara was killed that year. The Black Panthers had formed the year before. In 1968, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy were assassinated. Racial uprisings spread across the country. The Democratic Convention brought the war home to the Chicago streets. In 1969, university takeovers. Altamont. In 1970, Jimmy dead. Janice dead. Cambodia. Kent State. You will learn almost nothing about any of this from the show, or about the gay liberation movement, or about the gathering women's movement, although militant feminism makes total sense given the relentless sexism of psychedelic art in which all women are young, nude, available chicks, and very rarely artists. Nor would you have any inkling that, for Americans at least, pop culture during these years meant black culture. Apart from Hendrix's presence, the show is overwhelmingly white. Aretha Franklin's first big hits, Respect, Chain of Fools, and Natural Woman, were all 1967. You won't find her. Nor will you find Marvin or Smokey or Otis or Fontella or Ray. Again, take one style for the whole picture, you leave most of the picture out. Robert Haberle's much-reproduced print of the My Lai Massacre is here with its two-phrase overlay of text, question and babies, answer and babies. So we discover, in 40-year retrospect, love was never all you needed in the 1960s. In fact, it was barely there. No one these days is thinking, turn on, drop out. Everyone is thinking, how can I get into the game?
Make a useful tool of foreign policy for our country. Just try to let the sun shine in.
It's about 9 before the hour. We're going to try, during the break, the top of the hour, we're going to try to find that Hendrix Star-Spangled Banner and play the whole damn thing tonight. Oh, by the way, I got a bunch of emails from people today, and also one from Billy at Nova M Radio Network. He had gotten a lot of emails about, what's this, Mike's going to quit Nova M? The other night, when was it, Wednesday? Was it Wednesday, Kathy? Monday? I was frustrated as hell. I don't know how this stuff gets started. I start talking about I don't know how effective. I get worried about how effective this program is or how effective any of it is anymore. And that's one of the weak spots in what I do for a living, talk radio. You know, I get into the stream of consciousness stuff. And I just assume that my audience understands, oh, Jesus, Malloy's tripping again. And, excuse me, that y'all don't take it all that seriously. Now, that might be asking a lot of people who've followed this program around various spots on the dial because, Jesus, I have been fired a lot. Or have quit. I think I've only been fired twice, but I've quit like three times. And it's understandable if I said something, and apparently I did, about just giving it up. But it had been just a very weird Monday was a weird day, and it's difficult to maintain faith in the Democratic Party, which I don't think I can do anymore. But as far as leaving, no. God, no. I'll tell you when I'll leave Nova M Radio Network. Here's when I'll leave. If the network collapses or I die, wait a minute. There should be a third choice in there. Okay, when it's time to retire. Oh, okay, there's a fourth choice, when they fire me. But I've got pictures of the boss and his wife that they don't want released to the public, so I don't think they'll ever fire me. I should say the boss and her husband. But anyway, to the people who thought I was making some kind of a reference that I was going to bail out or this program was ending, hell no. Absolutely not. So, again, when you listen to this program, you have to understand that sometimes I just, you know, I get into these stream of consciousness riffs where I can't get out. You know, I'm just like, blah, blah. Blah, blah. Now, what I've noticed is, you know, real acid heads or people who've done certain drugs or lived a certain time in American history will listen when I get into one of those. They'll listen, they'll go, oh, yeah, well, he's going off again. It's only the younger people, you people under 40, who start to take it all very seriously. So trust me, there is no plan ever to leave this network. I mean, why would I? This is the best way to enter your retirement years, working.
Acid heads? Micah, may I remind you of the first rule of holes?
When you're in one, stop digging? Well, I've made no secret about the fact that I have used just about every illegal drug available. I am a product of the 60s. I came of age in 1963, for God's sake.
What I think you said on the air, and frankly, I don't remember if it was Monday or Wednesday, but one of those nights was something like, I don't know how much longer I can do this. I don't know how much longer this brand of radio, this style of talk radio will exist. It was sort of out there.
Oh,
so
okay.
I guess the acid reference
is
appropriate.
But that's a fair statement. That's a fair statement. We're on the brink of seeing Bush execute this directive that he signed that gives him all the power and more ever held by any sovereign or regent in the history of the human race. So it's a fair statement. It's kind of a global statement about this industry, about this form of talk radio. It's not about Nova M or Air America or Mike Malloy or Randy Rhodes or anybody. It's not. It's about the reality that we're dealing with right now. That was the context. Bush's power grab. So it's a legitimate statement. Who knows how much longer what passes for free speech in this country will continue to exist, especially so-called liberal or progressive talk radio or the internets. You know, fascism or any kind of totalitarianism doesn't tolerate dissenting opinion. I said 2 or 3 years ago, When it became apparent that a fascist takeover was in the offing by this Bush crime family, that for some people, you know, the ruling class, It's easy to live in a fascist society. And for the upper middle class, it's easy to live in a fascist society. You know, there's still the illusion of freedom. You're still allowed to make money and run your private enterprise. And the only thing you're not allowed to do, well, one of the things you're not allowed to do is to criticize the government under any circumstances. So that was the context of the statement. No, hell no, I'm not leaving Nova M. I tricked him into way overpaying me, and the hours are good. It's about 7 past the hour. Yeah, we found it. I had to dig around and find my 2-CD set from Woodstock. But a little bit later in the program tonight, we will, I don't know, maybe we'll do the whole 4 minutes of Star Spangled Banner. I don't think we have to pay royalties for that, do we? It's a public domain.
Well, he's really dead.
Well, but he really still has an estate, too. But the Star Spangled Banner, you know. But it is so bizarre to hear it. So, yeah, we're going to do it a little bit later. What else do we have here before we go to your phone calls? This intelligence report that the Senate has released is, again, I don't know what it will take to impeach Bush and Cheney. But here we go again. It turns out that before Bush invaded Iraq in 2003, U.S. intelligence predicted everything that's happening now, they predicted back in 2002. That's according to a Senate Intelligence Committee investigation report that was released today, released on Friday right before a holiday weekend. That's great. The predicted problems included an increase in al-Qaeda operations, sectarian violence within Iraq, Iran's effort to shape Iraq's future, all of this, if we invaded and threw out Saddam Hussein. Intelligence analysts, according to what I have here, also predicted that establishing a stable democracy in Iraq would be, well, practically impossible. Noting, it says here, that pre-war Iraq was a deeply divided society, intelligence warned that Shiite reprisals for their oppression under Hussein's regime would be a major concern to the Sunni elite and could erupt if not prevented by an occupying force. The report also says U.S. occupation of Iraq would lead to increased terror attacks and operations by al-Qaeda, which was judged likely to seize the opportunity presented by our occupation. That's according to the U.S. This is the intelligence that was presented that Bush and these other thugs decided to hide. In addition, the report said a U.S. occupation of Iraq, quote, probably would result in a surge of political Islam and increased funding for terrorist groups, end quote. Do you see what the Bush crime family has done to us? Do you see? And they knew this. They all knew this before they invaded Iraq. And apparently they just didn't care. The report goes on to say that invading Iraq would provide an opportunity for Iran to expand Iranian influence as well. And Iranian leaders might, according to the report, quote, try to influence the shape of post-Saddam Iraq to preserve Iranian security and demonstrate that Iran is an important regional actor, end quote. Now, who left for, how long has he been gone? Muqtada al-Sadr, who left Iraq 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks ago, 2 months ago, 3 months ago. He went to Iran, and he just returned within the past few days, according to U.S. Military intelligence. I mean, it just goes on and on. The Bush administration's refusal to pay attention to any of this. And I'll tell you who the lead refuser was. This murderous vampire, Dick Cheney, who now wants to do an end run around Bush to invade Iran. This guy is so close to his own, facing his own mortality. I guess he's like Jim Jones. He just wants to take as many with him as he possibly can. It's unbelievable. So it was all there. Everything was laid out for the Bush crime family. This is what will happen if we invade and then occupy Iraq, and in the process overthrow Saddam Hussein. This is what will happen. And every single prediction by hardcore intelligence has come through. Now, at yesterday's briefing, maybe you heard CNN's Ed Henry asking Bush about this Senate report, why he didn't heed the warnings of this 2002 report. Here's what Bush said.
Ed, going into Iraq, we were warned about a lot of things, some of which happened, some of which didn't happen. And obviously, as I made a decision of as consequential as that, I weighed the risks and rewards of any decision. As to Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Al-Qaeda is going to fight us wherever we are. That's their strategy. Their strategy is to drive us out to the Middle East.
All right, that's enough. I don't want to listen to this freak again saying the same things he said last night or yesterday. but his answer, his cavalier answer, just like the reporter said, why is Osama bin Laden still on the loose?
Because we haven't caught him yet.
I mean, this is insanity of the highest order. This is total disdain for the American public, for the U.S. military, for the Iraqi public. And yet, Pelosi and Reid continue to say impeachment's off the table. This is the worst example of failed leadership, if not in this nation's history, certainly in the past 100 years. This is astonishing. And the Democrats, or somebody decided that we need more death and more killing and more money to sustain the death and killing. And Bush stands here yesterday and states it categorically, my words, not his, but what he's saying is it's going to be a bloody summer. It's going to be gruesome and grim, lots of casualties, lots of death. You could almost hear him smacking his lips and rubbing his hands. And yet, he remains in office. I don't know, man. I don't know what it's going to take. Captain Jeff Leonard is an Army counselor deployed in Iraq. Army counselor. And his job is to interview soldiers, people who are suffering from what my parents' generation called shell shock, what my generation called a thousand-yard stare, what this generation calls post-traumatic stress disorder. And he had a sergeant, staff sergeant, a guy named Johnson, that he was interviewing. And I want you to hear some of this. Staff Sergeant Johnson in the interview says, "No, sir, I don't really sleep. Well, maybe an hour or two, then I get up. I don't want to dream." This is what the soldier said to the interviewers, Staff Sergeant Johnson. He was a good soldier, and you could tell when you spoke to him, he was a man of honor. He was ashamed to be speaking with us, but his leaders had insisted. He had served 3 combat tours as a squad leader in a line unit. His body and his hands shook during pauses in his speaking, and he stared at us, and sometimes past us, with a wide-eyed look of hyper-alertness. He had just returned from leave, and two guys in his squad were killed days before his return. He goes on, "You know, I thought each time you lose someone in combat it would be easier, but it's not. It's not." He shook his head and looked away from Major Johns and down at the floor. "It's not," he repeated as he stared at the floor. He looked back up at me nervously, still shaking his head. When he finally stopped shaking his head, his body erupted into a tiny tremor as he tried to keep still. He pressed and rubbed his palms against his knees as he sat, presumably to try to stop his hands from shaking. He shook his head and looked back down at the floor, and the tremor began again. He said, "Every time someone dies, I relive all the other deaths. Over and over." All right, there's more of this. Stick around.
Laura Pigglesbush. When Georgie falls asleep, I creep into the Oval Office, sneak a ciggy, and turn on Mike Malloy. Then I reprogram Georgie's speed dial. The simple pleasures.
This was at thinkprogress.org. Captain Jeff Leonard, an Army counselor deployed in Iraq, and his interviews with soldiers suffering from PTSD or combat fatigue or whatever you want to call it. He's talking with a Staff Sergeant Johnson here, and Staff Sergeant Johnson pressed and rubbed his palms against his knees as he sat, presumably to try to stop his hands from shaking. He shook his head and looked back down at the floor, and the tremor began again. "Every time someone dies," he said, "I relive all of the other deaths over and over." "That's a very normal response," Major Johns said. I nodded, and Staff Sergeant Johnson nodded back at us sadly and then looked away. "You know, I think going home on leave really told me how bad I was." Major Johns asked, "What happened on your leave?" "Well, not too much, really. Well, the first few days were good." "What did you do the first few days?" "Well, I checked into a nice hotel and got a bottle of scotch, and I didn't come out for about 4 or 5 days. It was great. I didn't get drunk. I just sipped, you know?" Major Johns asked, "What were you doing in there all that time?" "Just staring at the wall, really," he answered, and then drifted his gaze past us as if remembering. "I didn't turn on the TV or anything. I just stared at the wall. Well, for the first 3 days, anyway. I know it sounds weird, but it was really great." "Then what happened?" "Well, then my girlfriend came, and don't get me wrong, I love her, and she's a great girl, and all, but it just wasn't the same after she came. She's great, though. She's so understanding." "How did things go with your girlfriend? Did you get along okay?" "Oh, yeah. We didn't fight at all. No, we got along, but..." He looked from Major Johns toward me and hesitated. "But what, man?" I asked. "Well, I couldn't do it, you know? I mean, sex. We didn't have sex at all. Her skin just felt really weird. You know what I mean?" He sort of squinted and cocked his head to the side slightly when he asked if we knew what he meant. Major Johns replied, "No, not exactly. I don't know what you mean. What did her skin feel like to you? Describe it to us." like rubber, like an animal. He crinkled his cheeks as he remembered, as if it were repulsive to him. You know, like she wasn't real. We talked with Staff Sergeant Johnson for a while longer. He was one of the worst we had ever seen. When we mentioned the thought of him taking his squad out again, he simply said, "I can't. I won't. I won't load another body onto that chopper. I can't. I won't." It's at thinkprogress.org. It's called What the War is Doing to Our Soldiers. Her skin didn't feel real. Good God. In the meantime, Dick Cheney is really pushing to bomb Iran. According to Raw Story, a report published yesterday reveals a growing game of tug-of-war between Bush and Cheney regarding U.S. approach toward Iran. Cheney believes U.S. should not be pursuing a diplomatic path with Iran at all. And a senior aide to this vampire has been meeting with national security think tanks, right-wing think tanks and consultants in Washington to, quote, help establish the policy and political pathway to bombing Iran, end quote. That's reported Thursday on Steve Clemens' blog, The Washington Note. According to that blog, Cheney is the person in the Bush administration who most desires, quote, a hot conflict, end quote, with Iran. And the person who most believes the administration's pursuit of diplomacy led by Condoleezza Rice is a mistake. The Cheney aide, Clemens writes, who has met with policy people at the American Enterprise Institute along with other groups, quote, has stated to several Washington insiders that Cheney is planning to deploy an end-run strategy around the president if he and his team lose the policy argument. Cheney's team wants to work with Israel, nudging that country at some key moment to mount a small-scale attack on the suspected site of Iran's nuclear infrastructure, which could lead to an Iranian counterattack on U.S. forces stationed in the Persian Gulf. And impeachment's off the table.
This country has a new friend called Vice President Cheney. Dick is a killer. 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 Vice President.
Vice President, I've got great confidence in the Vice President, doing a heck of a good job. When I picked him, I knew he was a fine business leader and a fine, experienced man. And that matter will run its course, the Halliburton investigation.
Yes, 25 before the hour. By the way, we, like you, we're off Memorial Day, Monday night. We will not be doing the program. I don't think anybody will. I think they're just going to play a feed from the London Philharmonic. No, actually, I think it's going to be a so-called Best of Malloy, which is really not ever a best of. It's just a replay of some. No, I guess Billy or Ian do occasionally go through the archives and find a good one. So that's what we're doing Monday night. This weekend is the Atlanta Jazz Festival here, as it has been for the past 30-some years, at Piedmont Park, which is like Central Park in New York. Actually, it was designed, Piedmont Park was designed by the same man who designed New York Central Park. And so we're going to be there. Yeah, Olmsted was the designer. Thanks, Kathy. That's where we're going to be Monday night. Herbie Hancock? Is that who's playing Monday night? Yeah. One of the nights. It's like a three-day-long all-over-Atlanta affair. I love it. All right, let's do some phone calls here because people are starting to hang up now. They're saying, to hell with this. I've been holding on too long. Let's start with Scott in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Yeah, so much to be pissed off about these
Oh,
days.
Just tons of stuff.
Especially this last week.
Yeah.
You know something? Mike Gravel called it about the Democrats really not having any interest in pulling out of this war. I think with the exception of him and with the exception of maybe Dennis Kucinich, it doesn't seem like that they were really interested in pulling out of this war, especially if they're going to go ahead and vote for this, go ahead and vote for what I call the death funding.
Do you think Mike Gravel's statement is true? Do you really think that the Democrats just don't care about pulling out?
Well, I think what he said was is that they had the same interest as far as the Republicans, and that's which is controlling the oil interest. And that's basically what he says. And, you know, so far it, what's happened seems to be bearing him out to be true. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, what I find is very funny is that he did draft up the bill and he did present it. And you remember in the debate he talked about this and he talked about how to present it and how to tactically get it through. And, you know, he did get through to some of the senators and some of the congressional, and he did apparently get in contact with Pelosi's office, and they were supposed to have set up some meeting. But apparently, now, I don't know if that ever materialized or not, but I find it very funny why they would not go through with that, because essentially it was a plan that made any occupation past the 60 days illegal. It wasn't defunding the war. It was just at that point, right. After that, making the war illegal.
Right.
Now, you know, the fact of the matter is, and he said, no, well, it's not going to be easy, but, you know, you have to cause a confrontational, constitutional crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, the same stuff happens over and over again. So I think that he was right on the money about that. I really do. And we just see it over and over again.
Yeah, I guess it's just hard for me to think that Democrats, even the Democrats in Congress that I've lost respect for, that they have the same venal criminal interest in maintaining a war as the Republicans do. I know the Republicans do, but Republicans are amoral. They have no conscience, and for the most part, they have no soul. That's why they cling to their fundamentalist religion so strongly. They know there is no center inside themselves. But I have a hard time seeing Democrats in the same way, but apparently you feel it's true?
Well, I'm not saying all of them. I mean, certainly I don't think Kucinich is, but you certainly see a lot of them, especially with the ones who are running for office. I mean, look at where they're getting their money from, these special interest groups. You know, oil being one of them.
Yeah, well, you're right about follow the money. The pharmaceutical companies, I understand, are one of Hillary Clinton's biggest contributors. So pharmaceutical companies, military-industrial murderous complex, chemical companies, energy companies, you're right. They have shifted their contributions now to Democrats because they know that the Republican Party has pretty much shot itself in the face.
And I'm not saying that, you know, I'm picking a candidate as of yet.
Right.
For president, but right. Gravel is somebody I'm going to watch, and it's going to be very interesting that the Democratic debate's coming up.
Yeah.
And if depending on how these questions are phrased and how it goes, I know he's going to end up calling a couple of them out about what went on this past week and
well,
how they voted for this bill.
This next time I'm going to pay attention to Mike Gravel. I didn't watch the debates last time because I just wrote him off as
well.
As
I didn't
useless.
Either. I caught the clips on YouTube, but
right.
You know, it's very interesting. He seems to be the only one with the kind of passion. And you know, it's very interesting about the anti-war movement. It seemed like you were talking about the Summer of Love 40 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and the anti-war movement and stuff. Now it seemed like that it was the younger people, and with the exception of a few older people that were involved in pushing the movement. Now you have the opposite. you know, look who's out there fighting. Cindy Sheehan, who was in her 50s.
Right.
You have Richards. You have, you know, Gravel out there saying it. Even the progressive talk show people, yourself, Randy Rhodes, Tom Hartman, not saying you guys are old, but you're not spring chickens anymore.
Well, like they're not, but I am. So, I get what you're saying.
It seems like the inverse that, you know, it's the younger people that are the Nazis and are the disciples of the old liars and the Hannitys and the Limbaughs and all of that stuff. So, you know, it just seems like it's the inverse these days. And, you know, the news is not talking about this death bill that just passed. What are they busy sitting here talking about? This bitch fight that happened between Rosie and Elizabeth on The View.
Yeah.
That's the lead story.
I hear you. All right, Scott, thanks, man. Have a good weekend, okay?
Okay, thanks.
All right, take care. Take care. Although, I do think I saw a little bit of video on the news that Scott was pointing out tonight about the Rosie O'Donnell, what's her name, Hasselman? Hasselbach? As far as Rosie O'Donnell is concerned, well, the point, whoever was making the point, I guess it was Keith Olbermann, a reporter on Keith Olbermann's show. That's where I saw it. The point was being made that Americans are not paying any attention, and I think this is the point Scott was trying to make. We're not paying any attention to the debate or the votes in Congress about these issues, except when the votes have occurred. And then we either, you know, clap our claws together if we are Republicans, or we scream and run to the woods if we're Democrats. We're not paying attention to that. What we're paying attention to is how it's played by the pundits, whether it is on The Daily Show or right-wingers screaming at David Letterman or Rosie O'Donnell in a screaming match with this Elizabeth person. And, yeah, that's kind of true, isn't it? But that's pop culture. That's what's happened. And as far as the younger people back in the 60s, that's very true. We were in, I want to say my generation was in open rebellion against our parents' generation. That's pretty much what it was. We had enough. We watched Kennedy be assassinated in 63. We watched this war building up. We had a draft back then. Somebody sent me an email tonight. If you want to see the protests, and a lot of you said this over the past couple of years, if you want to see the protests in the streets, bring back the draft, which is maybe one of the reasons the Bush crime family refuses to do that. Because the draft was in full force back in the 60s, and you really didn't have any choice. The only choice you had was the choices that Cheney and Bush, well, everybody in that generation had. You could get a student deferment. You could get married. And when that didn't work anymore, you could have a child. You could be working in what was considered a critical industry. You could be a divinity student. There were all sorts of deferments available, mostly for white kids who just didn't want to go fight in this war. And when somebody like Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, said, and I'm going to say the N-word because he said it. This is a direct quote. When he said, "Ain't no Viet Cong ever called me nigger," and he refused to go. And you know what happened to Muhammad Ali? He was charged with whatever that constitutes, and he had his title stripped from him, and he was, you know, he was just absolutely chewed apart by media back then. Part of the reason was because he was a black man and a black Muslim, and he said, "Hell no, I'm not going to go."
Oh, And now we're at war, but we're at war to keep the peace.
Tom in Minneapolis writes, Mike, in conquest for oil, soil, and empire, the Bush crime family intentionally invaded Iraq for the express purpose of creating terrorism and more terrorists so they could turn around and say we need to fight an endless war on terrorism. It is not that they did not care if they created terrorists. They wanted to create terrorists so they could have more pretexts to fund the military-industrial complex. Yeah, you know, be careful, Tom. Trying to understand these insane people will, you know, peer into the... Remember, when you peer into the abyss is peering into you. Back to your phone calls. Let me see here. Toby is calling from San Francisco. Hey, Toby.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, I'm ready for medication.
Well, that's what I meant, too.
You know, I originally called and I was listening to you as I was saying, you know, our generation is going to have to get off our tushes and go to the streets.
Yeah.
Children of the 60s are going to have to get off their buns and get out there. And then, you know, as I was listening and all your emails, I realized we need a draft. I never thought I'd live to see the day I'd say that.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you that it wasn't just, you know darn well, it wasn't just the elite that were pulling fast ones to get out. There were quiet towns with country doctors who were finding little injuries.
Mm-hmm.
There was a whole movement, and, you know, Richie Havens and what you just sang. And, I mean, I told the screener, I wanted to say, look, it's our generation that's going to have to go back into the streets and take the night back. I mean, this candle waving and this flashlight waving. And as I was listening to everyone talk, I don't know what you think about it, because I never thought I'd live to see the day. But
I agree with you. You're absolutely right. If people in this country ever had to face a draft again, because that's not what we're used to doing. Republican.
I know, and you'd have your children in prep school worried about their brothers. You'd have a good old fashioned, you know, fight.
Well, Democrats would do it if you look at.
Harry Reid, you could blow him over. My God, he looks like a feather duster.
Yeah, he does. He does. All right, Toby. Thanks. I appreciate you checking in. We'll talk again. If we did have a draft again, Democrats would, for the most part, would probably go. If you take a look at members of Congress or people in the administration who served and who didn't, and why they didn't, you'll see that Democrats, for the most part, served the country. All the Democratic, most of the Democratic leadership, people like Daschle and people like Gore, and just about all the Democratic presidents. But the Republicans are cowards. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Mark is calling from Virginia. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing fine.
Hey, I got three real hardcore things I really need to ask you. First off, have you ever served in the military?
No.
No, okay. Secondly, how can somebody who is so against the war and so anti-war, celebrate a holiday that is remembering soldiers of the war?
I don't know. I don't know how I don't know how Bush does it. I don't celebrate war. If you're asking me, what I do. Let me answer the question. I'm going to hang up on you. All right.
Okay.
What I celebrate on Memorial Day, if I celebrate at all, which I normally don't, because it's like celebrating mass death. But the day was designed originally to honor World War One veterans, people who were sucked into that war, which was put together by the major powers of Europe. The United States tried to stay out of it and eventually had to get in it for a number of political reasons. It had nothing to do with freedom or democracy. So when I think about the lies and deceptions that have been told to young men and now young women over the past 50 years about why they should join the military, and I have watched literally tens of thousands of America's young people, usually the non-white for the most part and the poor whites, I've watched them pushed into the slaughter machine and murdered because of some sick psychopath running the government or a party that is psychopathic. It's heartbreaking. So I, in my little private personal way, Memorial Day to me is kind of a quiet recognition of the lives that might have been. There are 58,000 names on a wall in Washington that represents the 58,000 Americans who died in a war in Southeast Asia that was for absolutely nothing whatsoever. So I hope that answers your question. And all I can say is, Mark, we got a break, so I don't have time to listen to your third one. We'll be back after the break. Thank you. I'm Mike Malloy. Caller right before the break who wanted to know about my military service. I've, apparently he doesn't listen to the program too much because I've said it several times. In 65, I was called up to take my pre-induction physical at Jacksonville Naval Air Station in Florida, where I and my girlfriend at the time were living. And so I went, you know, with a busload of other guys, and we went out there to take our physical. And during that physical, we were asked a question. Have any of you ever had any kind of an arrest that involved a fine or involved jail time or a fine of more than $200? Well, I had gotten a speeding ticket that cost me $200. And I raised my hand and the sergeant called on me and he said, yeah, what do you want? Does the speeding ticket count? And, you know, he said something real snotty that embarrassed the hell out of me. But the answer was, of course it does. So they sent me to a morals waiver officer, some young kid in the Navy. And I sat down at his desk and I said, you got to be kidding me. Because I got a speeding ticket? He said, look, trust me on this. He said, I'm in the Navy, so I wouldn't have to go to Vietnam in combat. So take your morals waiver here. I said, well, what's going to happen? He said, they'll check it out. They'll go all the way back to the court in Toledo, Ohio, and find out what was involved here. I said, it was a speeding ticket. And I got snotty with the judge, and the judge hit me with a $200 fine for being snotty. And the young Navy guy said, Just do it. Trust me, just do it. So that delayed my induction for, we went ahead with the physical, and delayed my induction for, I guess, about 6 months. Well, in the meantime, they instituted the lottery system, and when they finally got around to people born on July 1st, which is my birthday, I think my number came up something like 212. And at the time, they were cutting off around number 86 or 87. For those of you who don't remember, they would have these lotteries. This was when it became clear that so many people were avoiding the military through all sorts of chicanery, like Dick Cheney did, like most Republicans did. They decided, all right, let's go to a lottery. Well, I wasn't in school, and I wasn't married at the time. I did get married, and my wife and I got pregnant, and that had an effect on it, too. When they reclassified me 3A, which meant that I would be drafted only if they landed in San Antonio and started to work their way up through Texas. But so just by pure serendipity, now, I had made the decision. Even back then, I knew what we were doing in Vietnam was illegal, immoral. It was unbelievable. So I had kind of, I don't know how firm I was on the decision, but I had made a decision that I would leave the country. I would go to Canada. I would avoid military service. Not out of cowardice, I don't think. You know, who knows what's really turning the wheels in your head. But because I had absolutely no belief that our battle in Vietnam had any bearing on freedom, justice, or the American way whatsoever. And as it turned out, of course, it did not, which doesn't prove me to be wise. It just proves that I was paying attention, I guess. Now, my brother-in-law, who wound up as a naval officer in Vietnam aboard the USS, was it the Enterprise, Kathy? Was he on the Enterprise? I think he was. Two tours in Vietnam and then shore duty in Italy. What he did, when he got drafted, he immediately applied for Naval Officer Candidate School, which is what I probably would have done. I was thinking about leaving and going to Canada, and I thought, no, I can't do that. So I would have, you know, not being college material at the time, hell no, certainly not being a military academy material at the time. I just figured, well, Officer's Candidate School would be a good place to go. So by serendipity, certainly not by design, because, you know, back then I couldn't find my ass with both hands anyway. All I knew is that the military was coming for me, and, okay, had it not been for that speeding ticket. Wow. So that's a long answer, pal, to your question. I know you were trying to be antagonistic, but I frankly don't care, you know. I really don't care. And as far as celebrating, if that's the word you use for Memorial Day, that's the wrong word. Commemorating is a better word, I think. I don't celebrate any war holiday. It's usually a day of shame and misery and death and ugliness and pain and grief and suffering and lives cut down and cut short and ended. And no, you don't celebrate that. I know you Republicans do, but normal people don't. So no, I don't celebrate Memorial Day. The best I can do is to try to put together a fleeting, I admit it, thought. Because if I try to think about it too deeply, I'll go mad. A fleeting thought about the hundreds of thousands of people that have died because some psychopath decided to wage a war. So there's your answer, right-wing caller. During the break, I got an email from DK Real. The Daily Dish is a blog written by Andrew Sullivan at theatlantic.com, Atlantic Magazine. And DK Real sent this to me. It has to do with Cheney again. Cheney is really insane. This is a madman. I mean, no rhetorical overload here at all. He is insane. Here's what Andrew Sullivan writes. My friend Joe Klein backs up the Steve Clemens account. Steve Clemens is another blogger, about Dick Cheney's bellicosity regarding Iran. This is what Steve Clemens wrote, or this is what Joe Klein wrote. I can confirm through military and intelligence sources part of Steve Clemens' account of Cheney's crazed bellicosity regarding Iran. In fact, having just received a second source confirmation of the following story, I was intending to post it today. Here it is. Last December, as Rumsfeld was leaving, President Bush met with the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the tank, the secure room in the Pentagon where the Joint Chiefs discussed classified matters of national security. Bush asked the chiefs about the wisdom of a troop surge in Iraq. They were unanimously opposed. Then Bush asked about the possibility of a successful attack on Iran's nuclear capability. He was told that the U.S. could launch a devastating air attack on Iran's government and military, wiping out the Iranian Air Force, the command and control structure, and some of the more obvious nuclear facilities. But the chiefs were, once again, unanimously opposed to taking that course of action. Why? Because our intelligence inside Iran is very sketchy. There was no way to be sure that we could take out all of Iran's nuclear facilities. Furthermore, the chiefs warned, the Iranian response in Iraq, and quite possibly in terrorist attacks on the United States, could be devastating. Bush apparently took this advice to heart and went to Plan B regarding Iran, which is a covert destabilization campaign reported earlier this week by ABC News. If Clemens is right, and I'm pretty sure he is, Cheney is still pushing Plan A. And then Andrew Sullivan writes, and you wonder who leaked the covert non-military policy against Iran? Yeah, of course, Cheney leaks all of this stuff. There's no doubt. Cheney is a murderous... I don't know. I'm thinking of a word without a cuss word because I've sworn off cussing. He's just a murderous, bloodthirsty thug. Cheney would have fit so comfortably into the German high command when they were butchering Jews and butchering gay people and executing liberals and Catholics and priests. Cheney is one of those rare individuals who is out of time. He doesn't belong here. He doesn't fit in here. He fits in more in an age where bloodlust was unchecked. The Crusades come to mind. The Nazis surge through Germany and most of the world comes to mind. Pol Pot's butchery in Cambodia comes to mind. Cheney is of that sort. He is just a total murderous madman. And he is still struggling to get the blood flowing even more heavily than it is. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm...
I don't worry about anything here in Washington, D.C.
Twenty-one past the hour. Very quickly here, a couple of emails and back to your phone calls. This is from Daryl in Montgomery. Mike, I was listening to the lyrics of a popular song by the talented young guitarist John Mayer as it played on my radio the other day. The song is called Waiting for the World to Change. It's all about this generation waiting for things to change. What happened to songs by young people wanting to change the world? Granted, it is one song, and you have many young listeners who go against this grain, but the song reflects the attitude of many young people I meet. So I think the caller, Toby, is right. The folk who fought for civil rights and against the war in Vietnam may well have to assume the lead in the fight against our current ills. Today's young people simply haven't had the experiences or the sense of urgency of the 1960s generation. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. We have become, or this this generation, I guess, has just become kind of deadened to so much, right? From Bruce in California, you said that Memorial Day was originally designated to remember the dead of World War I. No, that was Armistice Day, which eventually became Veterans Day. Memorial Day was originally Decoration Day, designated to decorate the graves of Civil War dead. Yeah, thanks, Bruce. I remember my mother always referred to Memorial Day as Decoration Day. So I guess it was changed within the past 50 years or so. From Bob in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Mike, last night my wife and I watched David Leaf's documentary, The U.S. versus John Lennon. And it was a powerful film. We lived through those turbulent times, but back then we really didn't realize what a courageous man Lennon was. The eerie thing about the film is how much it parallels what's happening in our country today. The difference, though, is how thoroughly politicized the people were back then, especially young people. I refuse to believe that the absence of the draft is the only thing holding us back from mass protests. By the way, did you see who won American Idol? And I hear Jory Buttafuoco and Amy Fisher are getting a new reality show. I get the point, Bob.
What, are they going to go door-to-door shooting people?
Joey and Amy?
What in God's name is wrong with this country? I had not heard that.
Yeah, well,
I'm watching the wrong news channel.
You are. You're watching. You got to get off of CNN.
You know, I'll tell you the problem. I started watching Fox the other day when I was sick, and I didn't have the strength to turn it off.
Oh, God.
And I started realizing, because all the Republican news lately up until this week has been bad, The all they can do is report on American Idol and Joy
Buttafuoco
and crime trials, and it's like there's no news.
Right.
There's no political
right.
news
well,
on
that's,
Fox
that's,
News
that,
anymore.
That's Fox.
I it's mean, all entertainment and murders.
That, well, sure. Oh, God. And I'm certainly not trying to dump on a younger generation here. When we do our youth nights on this program, or when we've done it before, all I get are kids who are so politically aware, but they're younger. They're 13 to 17. The people who really pushed the envelope back in the 60s were in their 20s. They were mostly college students, and you know, Bob disagrees. Bob in New Mexico disagrees, but I think they did have more at stake. As the saying goes in the South, they did have a dog in that fight, and that was their very lives, their freedom, the draft. And the student protests, there was also, I don't mean to cheapen it by saying it was just enlightened self-interest, because a lot of those people were also dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal, endowed by their creators with certain inalienable rights. In other words, the civil rights activists, whether they were black or white, or Latino, or whatever they were, Protestant, Catholic, Jew, they were all working for civil rights, for human rights, gay rights, women's rights, end the war, stop the murder, stop the madness. Now, if you're just tuning in, the reason we're talking about this, we're not on some nostalgia trip. It's just that the Whitney Museum in New York City has opened up an exhibit of Summer of Love is what it's called. It goes back to 1967, 40 years ago, and some of the memorabilia from that era, posters and music and installations and light and the light shows that happened back then. The psychedelic art, yeah, the drugs, the sex, the rock and roll. That's why people like Cheney, people like him, are so hateful of liberalism, because all that blew right past them. You know, Cheney decided to marry Lynn, and 9 months to the day after they got married, they had a kid so that Cheney could get another deferment. Coming back after this break, we'll set it up, but we're going to play our little tribute to Memorial Day, and that's Jimi Hendrix and the Star-Spangled Banner. Cry no more.
the most important lesson that I learned in Vietnam is that you cannot fight a guerrilla war with conventional forces.
Oh, really? That John Mayer song sounds like Smokey Robinson from John Mayer, I should say. Sounds like Smokey Robinson, doesn't it? Thanks, Daryl. 25 before the hour. All right, what we're going to play, what we're going to do now, I should say, is this is our commemoration of the millions of Americans who have died and the millions of deaths we have caused in our lust for war that allegedly are commemorated on Memorial Day. Let's face it, Memorial Day, like Labor Day, is just a big holiday for the furniture showrooms. Memorial Day sale, come in, no interest until 2012. Now, this piece of music by Hendrix, this is from the live album at Woodstock, and I don't know how it's going to sound to contemporary ears. It's pretty intense. And it wasn't recorded in quadraphonic. It was recorded during a live concert in a cornfield. So let's try it. Here is The Star-Spangled Banner by Jimi Hendrix. Thank you. play it that way at the next National League baseball game. Whew. Oh, my God. That, as far as I'm concerned, was the most authentic rendition of the Star-Spangled Banner ever performed. Ouch. Oh, man. I'm sorry. I just have to pause for a second here. That, like I say, it's just pretty intense. You know, that was recorded 38 years ago, and you've got to ask yourself, at least I ask myself, you know, where is that kind of insane creativity today? No offense to artists today. I mean, art is art, and art flows out of the times or flows against the times in which the artist lives. Whatever he or she chooses to do is you know, meant, or it should be meant, to challenge or threaten. I think all art should, on some level, and I think all real art does, on some level, threaten. That's why something like Andre Serrano's Piss Christ is immediately labeled blasphemous. Oh, my God, close it down, shut it off! Because it is so challenging and so threatening. And some of the musicians from the 60s and 70s, well, the 60s mainly, but in dribbling into the 70s, were such a threat. They were so anarchistic. Whatever the hell the word is, musical anarchy, artistic anarchy. It was just, and I'm talking about only their art, their what they produced. I'm not talking about their personal habits or what they did to sustain themselves or kill themselves. But their art, it was unbelievable stuff. And I just wonder, you know, can you imagine Jimi Hendrix doing that kind of music and then opening up a line of clothing? Or perfume? Jesus. No, I can't either. Can you imagine Janis Joplin endorsing, I don't know, whatever stars endorse now?
I don't think I'd want some Ode to Janis.
Ode to Janis, yeah. Well, that's our Memorial Day kickoff. Back to your phone calls. David in Denver. David in Denver has been holding on forever. David, thanks for your patience. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike.
Hey.
I was going to say that I think that's the first time the Star Spangled Banner was ever done in a non-traditional / religious, you know, way.
Yeah, absolutely. And it blew people away.
Yeah.
I was not at Woodstock, but I remember when I first heard that recording, and I think the first time I heard it was when I saw the movie, and it just nailed me to the seat.
Absolutely.
In the theater. I couldn't move. I just couldn't move. And the way the camera panned across his face when he was playing that, and keep in mind, it was just feedback and Hendrix on the guitar with a drummer back there kind of chuckling along with him. But my God, if you get a chance to see the movie Woodstock and watch that segment, watch Hendrix's face. It's just astonishing.
It is. There's also an excellent version that Marvin Gaye did.
Uh-huh.
At an NBA All-Star game. And it's on YouTube if people want to go look at it. I actually saw it a couple of weeks ago. It's a soul version, and it's really nice, non-traditional as well.
I'll have to check that one out.
Yeah, do that. I called about something else, but you've got me now going.
Can you hold on, David? We finally get you on the phone, and I have to put you on hold while we do a break. We'll talk when we come back, okay?
Thanks.
All right, just hold on. Go home. My baby. Go home.
I have said repeatedly, we are in a dangerous phase of this war. And as we learned, we lost life. But nevertheless, it is worth it, and it is necessary.
It's about 10 before the hour. We were talking with David. David in Denver. All right, where were we, David?
Oh, we were just talking about phones at that point. But there was something I wanted to point out, the lie in your story about your draft experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I can't believe that you had a smart mouth with a judge.
Well, I'll tell you exactly what happened. I think I was 18 at the time. And I got caught in a speed trap in Toledo, Ohio. And when I looked at the ticket later, they cited me for going 38 in a 28. Now, the truth was I was going 38 in a 25. So when I went in front of the judge, he said, "How do you plead?" I said, "Not guilty." And he looked at me and I said, "Because, you know, I'm cited for doing, there's no such thing as a 28 zone." Well, at that, the hammer came down.
They're smart ass.
Yeah, smart ass indeed.
I went after listening to you tonight, and that young Republican that called about Memorial Day, I want to say to him, Memorial Day represents us respecting and paying homage to soldiers who have died to keep us free and to give us our freedom. And we have lost so many freedoms that you've got to wake up. I'm 54. I had a 306 draft number, and so I didn't have to go through it. But America today is scary.
It is.
And, you know, I've gotten to where when the local high school here has a basketball game, I've got friends' kids that play on it, and I go over. I've gotten to where I cannot even go in before the national anthem because all the kids have started this thing where – when it comes to the verse about, or the land of the free,
right. They
all erupt into cheers. And I'm sitting there going,
"Oh God,
you fool.
Yeah.
You fools. Wake up."
Yeah.
My image of America growing up and was, you talked about Paul Simon last week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite lyrics of his is, from an American tune.
Yeah.
And he talks about how we come on a ship they call the Mayflower. We come on a ship that sail the moon. Mm-hmm. We come in the age's most uncertain hour and sing an American tune.
Yeah.
And that is gone.
Yeah, it is.
And it's so sad.
It is, David. I hope there is some sort of an awakening. I hope it happens. I have a lot of listeners who are in their 50s, a lot are in their 60s, who remember all this. And, you know, when I was a kid, people in their 50s and 60s were really old farts who had a hard time remembering what they had for breakfast. But I'll tell you what, the people in their 50s and 60s right now, what we went through was so intense and carved such deep grooves inside our brains and our consciousness that there's no way in hell that people who are in their 50s and 60s right now, and I'm a lot of people badmouth the boomer generation, but if you look at what the boomer generation did, we jerked this entire world right off its axis almost, and it's a shame there wasn't follow through, but I'm in that generation. I don't apologize for a damn thing.
Not a thing. Proud of it.
David, I got to leave it there. Thanks a lot, pal.
You bet, Mike.
All right, take care. I appreciate it. And thanks to everybody who made the show possible tonight and all this week. Ian Huff and Billy Pilgrim. You know who you are, Billy. Chris in Minnesota, our senior correspondent, Mark Marshall, our webmaster. Thanks also to Catherine Bay all this week, who's worked under some weird conditions this week. I'm not going to tell on you, but she had some kind of a virus that's going around. Always is, isn't it? And hung in here. So good for you. Good for you, Kathy. What else we got?
I'm all better in time for the non-Memorial Day celebration.
Yeah, I know. You know, when you come out of a real intense sickness, you come out almost euphoric because the pain has stopped. Right? So Kathy's been bouncing around the studio tonight.
Freedom!
Yeah. Of course, when that song was recorded, how old were you? 1 year old?
What year was Woodstock?
69.
Just barely.
Just barely a year old. Well, you've played a grand game of catch-up. You want to hit the music now? All right, let's do it. And have a good weekend, Memorial Day weekend. We'll see you Tuesday, same time, same station. All right, take care. Drive safely. Got to say that. And keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is the Nova M Radio Network. Have a great weekend, Kevin Kinney, wherever you are.